I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Ellis from London, and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question today is, would you prefer a lifetime supply of cake or a lifetime supply of pastries? Okay, here comes the show. And remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer,
hello,
pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Ellis from London's question, what would you prefer, a lifetime supply of cake or a lifetime supply of pastries? Dane, I'm going pastries because more variety. And in pastries, I think I can include the cheese and bacon turnover that I'm partial to. So that's an answer from me, Ellis. What about you, Dane?
It's a good choice. I would have initially gone for pastries as well for the same reason, the variety and just the seasonal viability of pastries. I feel like, you know, it's not like... If you serve a cake, like, for breakfast, it's good. Yeah, it's
where does muffin? Muffin come? Muffin's a cake.
Well, is the thing, is a muffin a cake, though? It does get quite
messy. Yes, muffin. Americans have tricked us to believe that a muffin isn't a cake. It is very much a cake.
Man, because with cake, you get far more variety because you get things like urinal cake. You get...
Rice cake. Carrot cake. Right, I was thinking rice cake, salt cake.
A cake of salt.
Yes, yeah, so you get a lot more cake... Right, you get a lot more cake variety as well. You also get, what was it called? Yellow cake, which is like enriched uranium ore as well.
Yes! So there's a lot more... You can make depleted uranium shells for firing into Iraqi tanks.
Yeah, if I get the right amount of yellow cake.
So, okay, so there's a lot going for cake as well, but I still like those cheese and bacon turnovers, so I'm sticking with pastries.
No, pastries is a good choice as well. You've got your pan of chocolate and all the rest of it. And,
yeah.
But then, are pies included in pastries?
I would include a kind of like steak bakey kind of pie in a you know, I think that counts for a pastry. So hotly debated. Ellis, listen, well done. If you want to get back in contact and tell us what defines a pastry, that would be useful. But suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
We absolutely do. No question is too big, too small, too asinine, too highbrow, or too funny or too sad. And if you do enjoy the show, please rate and review it on iTunes or catch us on Spotify where you never miss an episode, or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's largest podcast network, where you could never miss an episode and hear all the questions from our very special guests. With that being said, today's guest is a political comedian and writer. He was Scottish Comedian of the Year in 2017, 2018, and the UK Pun Champion in 2015. He has written for shows including Breaking the News, Mock the Week, and The Mash Report. He's also the co-creator of sellout show Hate and Live, which is improvising comedians hating on audience suggestions. And finally, he is running for Scottish Parliament for Lawrence Fox's Reclaim Party in the Glasgow Pollock constituency. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Leo Kearse.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Welcome, welcome. How's it going, Leo?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I'm running. I'm doing all the campaigning. We've all got a month till the vote. It's on the same date as the London mayoral vote. So I'm doing loads of political campaigning. What I've discovered is politics is really boring and complicated.
Good findings.
And everything's weighted to preserve the incumbency of the existing parties is what I found as well. Starting a new party, like, it's very hard to break in and get through all this sort of get over all the hoops. I know you don't get over hoops, you get through hoops, but I do things differently. You know what I mean? I get over hoops and I go through hurdles.
That's what politics needs, Leo. That's what politics needs. Someone thinking outside the box. Someone who's not even using a box. A person that's using a crate and they're wearing that crate on their head. That's what this is what the politics industry needs, Leo. So it could be possibly a welcome addition.
Leo, have you got like a slogan that you're doing for your campaign?
Free Scotland. Reclaim
free Scotland.
Reclaim your freedom. Reclaim Glasgow.
Nice.
Because I'm running. I'm a single issue candidate. I'm running against Humza Yousaf. So he's the SNP's justice minister. He's brought through this hate crime bill, which makes comedy illegal. It criminalises private conversations in people's homes. It's a ridiculous piece of legislation. Like, literally, you can't, like, in Scotland, it's technically an offence to call someone a tosser, because that's, like, autosexuality is a recognised sexuality now. That's somebody who's attracted to themselves and has sex with themselves. So if you call someone a tosser, you're discriminating against them based on their sexuality.
But you're not really discriminating. I mean, I discriminate against them. It's more of a pejorative term. And well, also, it depends what they're doing. I mean, you know, obviously we understand that consent is never going to be an issue with an autosexual. But at the same time, by the merit of them being an autosexual, I don't want to be within the personal space when they've been able to embrace their sexuality. Now, the thing is, if we are attributing this to a recognised sexuality of all sexuality, then how do we distinguish autosexuality from, let's say, narcissism?
I think it's part of the same thing. I mean, if you're in love with yourself so much, you're going to have sex with yourself, as opposed to, you know, I think most people, when they have sex with themselves, it's more of a sort of just a release. It's not because we love ourselves, it's because, you know, we sort of, you know, it's fun.
I think sometimes people masturbate when they hate themselves, to be fair.
I was about to chime in there.
Howard's right there. Oh, we're not hate weights. All right, Howard, you have the floor. Finally, your subject. Finally, a question for Howard alone.
Well, if people want to hear about hate wanks, I've actually got a new podcast starting called Hate Wanks. No, I haven't actually.
I'd argue a large part of the patronage and following of the pornography industry is largely people that engage in, like, hate wanks.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, or engage in wanks and then experience hate afterwards. Like, everyone's had post-ejaculatory shame. You know, this is where incels really come from. It's like, for those, you know, incels are somebody who feels ashamed after masturbating, but, you know, it's the lady's fault. We understand.
Listeners, if you are suffering from any of these problems, hashtag hate wanks.
Don't call it suffering. If you want to live your truth as an autosexual, then you are free to do so. Whether we are all going to be on board for a pride parade for that nature, I'm not too sure. Yeah, odds
that's
are,
fine.
I imagine the logistical nightmare of getting a bunch of autosexuals to organise like a jack-off parade would be... wouldn't get anything done, really. I don't imagine how industrious are autosexuals typically, because I feel like my productivity tends to suffer if I ever, you know, how can I put this, Leo, I am what would people refer to as autosexual curious on occasion. So I may, you know, engage in some autosexual eroticism every now and again, but, you know, never knew there was a group out there that could, you know, be there for us. So I've learned something new already.
So, Dane, with that being said, it's probably time for a question, as the format of this show dictates.
Absolutely. So, Leo is our very esteemed guest. We welcome you to ask a question, whichever kind of question you'd like, which we'd love to discuss for about 15 minutes or some change. Then Howard will do the same, and we'll have a quick talk about Howard's question. Then lather, rinse, repeat. I'll ask a final question to you, which we can discuss for 50 minutes and change. And when it's all said and done, we can let our amazing listeners know where they can find out more about your stuff and for potential support of your current campaign. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
Cool, cool. Well, then the floor is yours to ask the first question, please.
Well, my question is, why are people so happy to have overbearing governments with authoritarian rules such as the policing bill, the hate crime bill, the lockdown restrictions, vaccine passports, etc.? Everybody seems to be, I mean, not everybody, but a huge swathe of the population, the majority of the population seems to be happy with all these restrictions and having their sort of basic human rights of freedom to assemble, freedom to travel, freedom to associate with who they want, having all these human rights taken off them.
It's a great question.
It's a very good question.
What's inspiring this question from you, Leo, and kind of where are you standing on it at this current time in history?
Well, I'm just surprised to see it happen. I mean, throughout, you know, I was born in the, let's just say the mid-80s, and, like, you know, I grew up, you know, during the 90s, you know, the 80s and the 90s, when everybody was pushing for freedom and individual rights and, you know, equality and tolerance and things like that. And now it feels like we've rolled back. And, you know, on a sort of world scale, you know, we always thought that undemocratic countries, you know, the countries throughout the Middle East and China, they'd move towards democracy, they'd move towards freedom and individual rights. And instead, it looks like the opposite is happening. Like, China's definitely not becoming more democratic. And in the West, we're giving up. We're giving up our human rights. And, you know, we don't seem to be in a hurry to get them back. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, protesting against COVID restrictions, protesting against the policing bill. But there's other legislation coming through that people seem to be happy with. And even the policing bill, which is terrible legislation, and the hate crime bill in Scotland, most people seem to be happy with it. They're like, yeah, like, fine. Let's start policing my opinions. And, you know, obviously we've got Alexa and Siri listening in my house to give a live feed to the government if they want to arrest anyone they want for being a dissident. It's weird. I think we're sleepwalking into dangerous territory.
What do you think, Dane? Where do you stand on this contentious issue?
I think we've kind of been on the way there anyway, man. So really what we're seeing now, Leo, is like the precipitation of laws that began to be moved and I guess wheels that were going into motion as far back as the Patriot Act, when that was being brought into play, where, you know, in most cases where people volunteer for their rights to be taken from them, we had this whole fear and hysteria around Islamophobia and against terrorism. And once people feel very scared, then they are a lot more inclined to give over their power to a government or to a authoritarian institution for them to feel a lot more secure. So I think, even if I remember seeing loads of newspaper articles and tabloids where there was a story about a guy who was climbed on a roof and they wouldn't let him down and he refused to come down from a roof unless he was given a meal, and it was in accordance with his human rights with European law. And there were just numbers of different instances where like people couldn't be deported because of European law. And there was this real indoctrination within British society where it was almost as if, well, we need to take away their human rights. And that began, I believe, to manifest in the form of Brexit, where some people are like, we need to move away from EU law so we can protect ourselves from immigrant criminals and international criminals and screen them. And there can be some validity to those concerns, but people can always take them and subvert them and get away with literal murder. And I think we are at a point now where I think people are so desperate for some form of stability, especially given the last year, that they're probably not even thinking so much about the erosion of their liberties because...
Well, it's because they've taken them for granted, right? For years now, like our generation particularly, right, Dane? It's just like...
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah, as I said, I too, like Leo, was born in the mid-80s. And yeah, I can very much see a real change, particularly from people from my generation as well, where it's that kind of I'm a rat jack phrase. And I think because in the West, people enjoy a certain level of comparative privilege compared to the rest of the world, what they see as that, I think people have become a lot more aware of that privilege, given a lot of the geopolitical shifts and the flux that we've seen. And so people are happy to enjoy that comparative privilege. And so people probably just think, well, we are prepared to sacrifice these small freedoms if we are allowed to maintain a certain level of prestige around the rest of the world. So I just think that's one of the reasons why. And like you said, Howard, I think it's for granted. I think most people, if their standard of living, as it's represented by access to the internet, access to food, access to digital media, I think, you know, access to recreation, I think for most people in the West, if they're still able to access stuff like that, then they don't really care about erasure of their rights. You know, you look at how people behaved over lockdown. Some people, like, you know, didn't break lockdown in order to see their family. They weren't breaking lockdown in order to protest or to, you know, reference their rights and their human and civil rights. People were breaking curfew to go and see, you know, friends and go and have parties and go to restaurants. And, you know, people like Rita Ora having secret birthday parties. These aren't people, I don't think, who are concerned with the erasure of their human and civil liberties. It's people that are still enjoying relative, you know, recreation and privilege. So I think that's one of the reasons why people have just been so easy to give stuff over, is because we're still on lockdown. Most people don't even realize what they're going to lose until we come back out of it.
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of these rights, and I think it was a big part of speculation for most people, is that we have left lockdown with a lot less rights than we had when we went in. And I think particularly having the right to protest being removed are following a pandemic, following a shared civil experience.
Yeah.
To be able to try and protect civil liberties is very, very, very fucking dodgy.
When the civil liberties were taken away and people saw, you know, police enforcing protests, you know, so there'd be anti-lockdown protests and the police would go in and, you know, arrest people and beat people up and stuff. So people just thought, oh, well, that's just, you know, there's some fringe, you know, far right lunatics that are protesting for, you know, against lockdown and stuff. So I think they saw it as something that would never affect them. And if it did, it would be like 10 years down the line that they started, you know, the police started stomping on
regular people. Yeah.
Well, then we saw with the Clapham, that Clapham vigil. I mean, it was immediately, you know, it's like a matter of weeks that it takes for the police to suddenly start, you know, boshing just, you know, middle-class white women holding candles.
One of the things about it to me, Leo, is you know, you talk about engagement, right? That's kind of, I think, part of the crux of this question, which is this kind of like, how can we all just be sitting by letting this shit happen?
Yeah.
And I think one of the problems is that if you say, take the example of protest, right? So we are going to protest about something. I think there's a load of people who think, well, what good does fucking protesting do?
Yeah.
Which we can come back to, right? And there's a load of people who think, well, you know, if you take away my right to protest, how will I change the world? Well, no offence to those people, but I'm not quite sure how much protesting is changing the world. I think there are types of protest that can change the world. For example, I think almost every football team is going to give up social media, which will definitely fuck off the social media platforms and make them clamp down on racism. That's an interesting form of protest.
Why do you think football teams are going to do that?
So they've just started. It's happened. There's like three teams that have just done it.
Oh, really?
The day of recording.
Oh, because of the racist abuse they've been getting on social media.
Yeah. So there are a few. I think there's a couple of teams who've already done it. And but anyway, my reason for bringing that up is just to say that there's an interesting protest that would work. Whereas, for example, the protests against Donald Trump visiting the UK.
Yeah.
No offense to all the people that went to that, and I know a lot of people who went to that. You didn't change a fucking thing. Now that's where engagement with what the point is of the protest, as in like, how can we improve our world, probably still the crux of a lot of social and political conversations.
Yeah.
Are they really engaged on the right level?
Well, I think that is a part of the question for political impotence is that, you know, when I think what we've seen in terms of protests have supposed to be the manifestation of the extreme views that we see on social media. And I think most people, despite how they may postulate on social media, don't have as extreme views in real life, because most people, by any stretch, especially if you're occupying the same land space, the same city or the same area, there's going to be a certain level of you're going to be somewhat moderate in your platitudes in your daily life. Most people aren't necessarily that extreme in that, for example, I might have a lot of anti-conservative rhetoric, but it doesn't mean I'm going to go feral if I'm in the same green room as a conservative comedian, for example. And there are going to be some platitudes which...
Is that true, Leo, or is he giving you shit? Is it true, Leo?
Yeah, he throws the cans of coke around in the green room, flipping over tables.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, is this enough deregulation for you? Have some American drinks.
I'd love to watch that.
Liberal with these fizzy drinks. Howard, just to follow the saying, I just think that what the problem has been for people is because, as Leo said, that you see these extreme examples of political assembly in the terms of like extreme right demonstrations, or, you know, some people might say Antifa and BLM, and I think the press and media have focused on these extreme groups so much so that it's made everyone think that anybody that appears for any kind of political assembly, and sometimes, Howard, I get what you're saying, like, what good does it do? Sometimes performative protest can be somewhat useful. If anything, it's because of the fact that as a social species, human beings sometimes need to see other people sharing the same platitudes as them.
Completely agree.
Even though there might not be an executive change, or it might not be a catalyst for an immediate legislative change, sometimes just seeing other people think in the way that you do can be empowering to a group of
people.
And
I think it makes people sit up and notice things. I mean, the Black Lives Matter protests, if they hadn't happened, you know, for all that I've been critical of, you know, the rioting and the destruction of property, they definitely made people sit up and think, you know, this is serious and we need to, like, you know, we need to sort of recalibrate and pay attention to you know, how we're interacting with people from different ethnicities, and made people, you know, reassess themselves and their own personal actions and judgments and things like that.
Yeah, that's just spark a conversation, as you said. And also, the thing about the protest and, like, the writing and stuff like that, like, I appreciate people that agree with it. There may be elements I agree with, elements I don't agree with. But I think this is that kind of helps towards answering the question, is that we have to accept the ugly side of demonstration and protest if we're going to appeal to retain our civil rights. So, you know, in the same way that I like carnival, but I don't like the fact that when carnival's finished, there's bottles and litter strewn everywhere, mounds of horse shit from the police being mounted and stuff like that. So, you know, there's an ugly side to it as well. You know, there's the fallout of going to like a nice festival. I like going to the Fringe, but then, you know, and I find it very strange as well, like a duality there, Leo, is that the Fringe is largely patroned by people that consider themselves liberal.
Yeah.
But when it's done, it's a fucking ecological and sustainability disaster. There's flyers everywhere, like paper being wasted, posters going to waste all the time.
Glitter.
Food disposal is glitters everywhere. Like, we don't know if that enters if that's biodegradable, if it enters into the water supply in Scotland.
It goes in like, dolphins' eyes.
Well, there you go. It can go in dolphins' eyes. I mean, they do rape, but that doesn't mean that we can presume that they deserve any kind of karma before they get a
not all dolphins, trial. By the way. Not all dolphins.
Some do. Right. So, yeah, exactly. Just because you suspect, you know, some people do stuff, it doesn't give them an automatic death sentence. But,
yeah
I think it's, we have to accept the ugly that comes with protest as well. Like, I think if we're going to have a level playing field of free speech and the ability to write to protest and demonstrate, it means even someone like myself, I have to, you know, accept that if someone like National Action or Britain First or the EDL want to demonstrate, even as farcical or as nonsensical as I believe their narrative to be, they should have the right to protest. I think what has happened is because we see so much of the demonstration of the extremes in discourse on social media and the like, it makes all of us think that anyone that is a dissent or detracts from what we say is massively extreme. Yeah. And we just seem to think that protest just comes down to just anarchy.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I find really interesting is that, you know, the issues that should, you know, everybody should care about equally get divided on left and right. So, for example, the policing bill protests in Bristol, which, you know, overall I support. I mean, I don't support, you know, stuff getting set on fire or whatever, but I support the protest and I think the policing bill is terrible. As a right-wing person, I support the protest against the policing bill. And I think it's terrible that frontline police are being forced to put their lives at risk defending it. But a lot of sort of conservative people see that as a bad protest, whereas the anti-lockdown protests are seen by conservatives as good protests and seen by the left as bad protests. When I think, you know, we should all be protesting against, you know, the overly officious lockdown rules, and we should all be protesting against the policing bill.
Absolutely, and I think that's the problem. There is that we in our pursuit of positioning ourselves along political spectrums.
Yeah.
Like, we've done it almost like musical chairs, or if, like, you know, the bipartisan eagle is like flying away, we have to sit ourselves on a wing before it goes. And I think that's the problem, is that there was a time where, as I said, Leo and I may sit at what are, you know, narratively may appear opposite ends of the bipartisan spectrum, but there is an intersectionality there which you don't get on social media because, and I keep referring back to it, is because now digital media and algorithm plays a big part in human consciousness now. Yeah. That works binary. It's zero and one. And so human beings are trying to contextualize themselves as saying zero and one.
Yeah.
And that's not always straightforward as that. And, you know, in the same way that, like, you know, even though some people have very extreme views when it comes to the fluidity of gender, there are lots of elements in terms of what the demonstration of masculinity and femininity are that aren't as rigid as gender. And that's what people fail to understand.
Yeah.
You can be a man with feminine traits. You can be a woman with masculine traits. And then, you know, within that spectrum of the secretion of your testosterone and estrogen, you will have a certain level of gender fluidity, which in itself is then going to be influenced by regional culture, depending on where you realize your gender and your sexuality and those customs.
Yeah.
And it's those conversations that we don't have anymore and are preventing us from being able to have conversations on a larger scale, because human rights, irrespective of your political disposition, should be a given.
Yeah.
So if we're at a point now where we are so focused on arguments on more little nuanced things like, well, I think we should pay tax. Well, I don't think we should. Well, I think we should all be able to fucking eat. I think we all should be able to say how we feel. So
I think eating food is a privilege. Eating food is a privilege, not a right. what I got from that Dane is that you sound like you're becoming more conservative. You're finally, this is happening, isn't it? I reckon 10 years time you're going to be voting Tory.
Oh God, I hope not.
That's what makes this podcast a special place, Leo, because we're into episode 100 and something now, and, you know, some of the responses we get from our listener base, and love to all our listeners, you know, that we realise that we are not serving one particular narrative. The dialogue, and particularly the format, different questions, facilitate Dane and me and our guests to have just some open dialogue that doesn't feel like we're trying to run along a particular tram line. That's the problem right now.
That's the thing as well, Howard, is that if my narrative may change, and if my narrative does begin to border on a conservative, that could just be a part of my journey and just my, you know, for enlightenment, just as a person, as a human being. And that is open to change. I might say something, and people might be like, you are completely wrong, Dane. What is important for human beings is to understand is that, like artificial intelligence, you are open and you are able to upgrade. So you can recalibrate your software and your understanding of the world based on new stimulus and new updates and to changes to your environment.
It used to be called evolution.
And it's so strange that people that champion that so much are so rigid in their ideas and beliefs and not open to change and stuff. Because just on the subject of what Leo just said real quick, is because he said about, I think that food is a privilege and not a right. Like, you know, at first I was like, oh my God, but there's some validity to that in that I have recently, Howard, I'm sure you're aware of this, I've been called a fatphobe on this podcast twice. And I wasn't aware of that case. But at the same time, while I feel like access to food and nourishment within a developed country should be a right to anybody who is a part of a nation that feeds into a tax base and provides municipal services, I think there's no reason why we shouldn't be feeding children. But I also think that there is a quasi fiscal and financial merit to that if you have a populace who have access to nourishment and a basic access to education, those people can only in turn benefit your economy and benefit your infrastructure because they have the basic physiological needs satisfied so they can go out and do work and go forth and produce.
Of course.
But by the same token, you know, while I wouldn't want to stigmatize somebody for their appearance and their body shape, one of the reasons why a colloquial term like fat cats exist is because we knew that the fatness and the gout and the bulbous noses of, you know, politicians and the elite that enjoyed excess was represented by them having being overweight. Not because I'd like to think there is a distinction between, you know, the pathology behind compulsion and how eating disorders or body dysmorphia can come into that. But I think that's very distinct from the discussion about, you know, allocation of resources and excess.
Yeah. And what it taps into again and again is this sense that there are these tram lines that people are just running down and they're not able to.
Well, people are scared, Howard, because remember, we are on the cusp of the unknown. This is the other thing as well. And I'd say to both of you guys as well, one of the reasons why, Leo, is because I think people, just to more succinct answers of why people are giving away these human rights, is that I think humanity is very scared. I think we've reached the apex of the efficacy of the world as we live in exists.
Right.
And I think we're about to be redrafting redraft our social fabric globally.
End of an era.
And I think a lot of people, we're at the end of an era. And I think a lot of people are scared, Leo. So they're trying to hold on to these pre-existing systems, even if they become a lot more rigid and draconian, because the unknown is what scares them more.
Yeah.
But this this feeds into my question for today, which I'm going to diverge into.
Nice.
And Leo, you know, that your question was superb. And I think there may be a lot of our listeners who maybe, you know, are going to hear about you for the first time, Leo, and maybe vote for you. Who knows? But your comedy definitely gets a response would be my, like, there's a clip of you that you know, we'll share it on our social media, the one at the backyard comedy night, which you may just want to kind of lightly quickly describe for our listeners to know the kind of stuff that you often talk about on stage.
Yeah, so this is a night that I get criticised for doing. Basically, it's Dane's done this night as well, but it's really fun. It's like a sort of free speech comedy night where comedians are encouraged to not self-censor, because the majority of censorship isn't being imposed by external bodies. It's not people turning up with placards and stuff. It's the comedian themselves saying, you know, oh, maybe I shouldn't say this. Maybe this is too much. So they encourage you to sort of have confidence in your ideas. You can come out and say, and, you know, they're not just taking people from, you know, conservative voices or whatever, people from all over comedy. You know, so you can do material that really sort of pushes the envelope.
And there was a clip that I saw, Leo, that I was watching, and I told a joke, part of a joke of it, to my wife, and she laughed. My wife runs a sustainable environmental business, and she still laughed at some of your material. The joke I used, or I told her, was not used, by the way, just told was that you said that, you know, all the children in cages on the border of America, You couldn't quite understand why there was such an uproar because you thought that all children should be kept in cages, which given that my 10-month-old child is in a little pen in the corner of my living room as I tell that story, really resonated with us. But the thing that I wanted to ask you and Dane is that obviously the thing that happens when you do that type of comedy is it gets a lot of people upset.
Yeah.
And my big question to you both is, what are the woke... the woke world, which I believe we need some of, but what are they getting wrong?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
That's the bit that I think we should address today. What are they doing wrong, Leo?
Oh, my God.
I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Where do you even...
Because there's stuff they're doing right. There is stuff they're doing. I'm going to point that out just to begin with before we get annoyed. People annoyed. There is stuff that they are rightly fighting.
Well, I don't know what they're getting right because, I mean, it's certainly not, certainly not personal grooming or anything like that. No, wokeism, I mean, like they're getting everything so wrong because wokeism, I mean, the essence of it is good. It's you know, it's being aware of social injustice and trying to make the world a better place. But I think everybody's trying to make the world a better place. You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So they're going about it completely the wrong way. They're doing this sort of performative, you know, social media posts that don't do anything. They're very divisive as well. They just they sort of attack people instead of educating them. I mean, I grew up in rural Scotland, so you know, there's a lot of you know, opinions about race and about homosexuality and things like that would be very unpopular in Islington in 2021. But the people saying them weren't, like, they didn't mean to be hateful. They were just ignorant. And I think most of the stuff that's seen as like hatred or intolerance is just stupidity and ignorance. And, you know, once people, I mean, one of my best mates, you know, he was when he was a teenager, he was racist. And but then he got to, like, you know, 19 or 20 and travelled. You know, he spent time in Southeast Asia, spent time in North Africa, and came back completely different. He'd met people from, you know, all around the world, and he'd seen that, you know, we're all pretty much the same. You know, obviously there's cultural differences and stuff, but we're all, you know, essentially we can have a drink and have a laugh together. And so I think, you know, most woke people treat racism and all these issues as if, you know, the people doing it are evil, and, like, you know, any slight infraction of you know, their woke tenets, which change week to week, by the way, so I don't know how they can treat it like it's so religiously pure. Any sort of minor infractions are due to the person being inherently evil, and they're a witch, and they must be burnt. So and also I feel like wokeism is just, it's become, you know, we became a secular society. You know, most British people aren't religious anymore, and I think that goes, you know, across the West. Religion's sort of gone from our lives, so wokeism replaces that. It's got everything. It's got the submission, it's got the high priest telling you what to do, it's got these religious tenets that have to be followed, and it's got the shame and the guilt and the punishment. It's like Catholicism but without the forgiveness.
The thing that I can't, you know, like, I'm like naturally a liberal guy, Leo. Although I don't even really know what that means as much as I used to, but I know that that I believe in equality, yeah. and I believe that there are elements of our society and our civilization that don't seem fair, and I want them to be fairer because I want the most people that can be happy to be happy, because I think that's what ultimately I think most people deserve. But as Dane and me talk about, you know, again and again, there is something going on, and it's gone on for the last decade or so, and it's probably going on longer, but it's really hit home this last decade on the left, that just makes them feel repugnant in the way that they're approaching dialogue, right, Dane? And we've talked about this multiple times.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, first of all, it's the real issue, I guess the tragedy of the colloquial term woke is that it's a culturally appropriated term that used to have more of a reference to Pan-Africanism. It stems from the fact that, I guess, the collective consciousness of the diaspora was considered to be ignorant and unenlightened, so far as A, ignorant to the plight that we were suffering, ignorant to our historical trauma that has contributed to our current state, social state. And so woke really pertained to being able to do your own autonomous research and referencing in order to find out who you are and where you are from as a person. So the original purpose of the term woke was to represent an awakening of consciousness as opposed to a personal experience rather than one where, because it's not really about being woke. Woke is, well, these guys aren't really woke. They're more wakers, as in that, like, they keep trying to roughly wake people out of their dreams and their illusions. And, you know, you referenced being happiness, Howard. I think they say the happiness, the definition being reality minus expectation. Mm. And I think the problem with the neo woke contingent is that they are unhappy. They had expectations and are not happy with reality. And so as a result of that, I'm going around shaking everybody, being like, wake up. And people are like, I'm not even sleeping. I'm just resting here. What the hell is your problem? So I think the idea of being woke has been appropriated, and the term itself, like feminist, has been subverted for commercial gain. I think you can always, particularly within a Western society, follow the money and see why wokeness is so wrong. So, for example, in terms of the recognition of the LGBT community by, like, Sainsbury's, for example, that does appear to be woke, and you could say what they're doing there is wrong. And I'd say where they're going wrong there is that might be performative solidarity with the LGBT community. But if Sainsbury's really wants to demonstrate solidarity, then it would be more inclined to maybe not lobby politicians that make any laws that are regressive to the community, or to make a concerted effort to educate its audiences, or you know, invest in providing opportunities for members of the LGBT community if they want to be that way themselves.
Yeah, and Sainsbury's is an interesting one because they do a lot of performative wokeness. And, you know, for Black Lives Matter, they sort of put out this message that they were the only non-racist supermarket, and, you know, other supermarkets were racist, which is ridiculous considering. Well, it's ridiculous anyway, but also considering that Sainsbury's had an all white management board until the Black Lives Matter their marketing campaign kicked in, and then they like hired a token person for the management board. It's ridiculous. And also Sainsbury's are like, their major investor is the Qatari royal family, and it's like, if you really care about LGBTQ rights, wouldn't you like do something to change the laws in your own in Qatar?
But that taps into so many interesting elements of why I kind of, you know, I look, I'm just, let's just make it really clear for our listeners again. We fight ignorance and prejudice on the right wing that we fundamentally disagree. If you're talking to a, you know, a show fronted by a black guy and a Jewish guy, right? You know, we shouldn't need to say that, but it's important just to remind.
We do need to say that, Howard, because, you know, you have people like Clarence Thomas is the Attorney General of the United States, and he is Republican. Mm. And then you have, you know, someone like Jared Kushner, who was married to Ivanka Trump. So, you know,
of course.
Being a member of particular ethno-social groups doesn't predispose you to have certain views. So, you know, and that's the thing with being woke as well, is that there's sometimes a presumption that based on someone's aesthetic or archetype, that they should hold particular views. And, you know, that does play out, I would say, for example, when you see pundits like Candace Owens or Stacey Dash.
But I think the best example of the you know, kind of trying to encapsulate some of this woke kind of what our issue is with wokeness is the players in the Premier League taking the knee as a matter of they have to take the knee. And that I just find it despicable, because, you know, and the idea that, you know, Wilfried Zaha, who is a man who has probably experienced an infinite amount of racism on the football pitch and from the fans, gets, you know, hauled across the coals because he didn't want to take the knee anymore. And it's like,
And that's the thing, is maybe one of the quick ways you could say it is that what the woke or the woke left are doing wrong is that they are trying to employ the same tactics as the people that they claim to lament, because it's not for anyone who has not had the lived experience of Wilfred Zaha to show him how he's supposed to rationalize and respond to institutional racism. And it's a perfect example of what doing wrong is that you're trying to show some kind of performative solidarity rather than addressing the actual issue. So, yeah. You know, that's an example whereby they've... And I mean, in a way, like, and I'm sure, Leo, you appreciate the irony of being like, well, black man, you don't like racism. Well, do what we tell you to show us that you don't like it.
Yeah, you see it.
You know, for any black person, I think, like, suggesting a knee or taking a knee in order to show equality as opposed to passivity doesn't really make sense anyway. Like, you know, people are like, I'm going to show I'm strong by bending over in front of my oppressor is not really...
Well, and to me, it also taps into, you know, you kind of... Leo mentioned the whole thing with Sainsbury's and the Qatari family, right, Leo?
Yeah.
That's, you know, like... I look at the way people are approaching kind of the evolution. I want to make the world the best place it can be, right? So I'm trying to evolve it, and I'm trying to protest and actively engage people to change their views that I feel are wrong. And it's like, well, how are you doing that? Well, I'm going to protest against the Trump family. Right, so you're telling me that in a country that doesn't run your... You know, this is America, you live in the UK, you're going to spend your time protesting against Trump when, let's be honest, and it's an unfortunate reality... Even what Trump did for however many years doesn't even come fucking close to what some other countries do in other regions of this world. Yeah. That it's probably just not as easy a narrative for them to get behind. And that's where the woke kind of agenda does feel like a bit of a constructed, slightly kind of nonsensical is a bit harsh, but like it doesn't have as much logic as it should.
But see, Howard, wait, that's very woke, Howard. You can say it's nonsensical, Howard. Call it fucking nonsensical.
I wanted to say it's illogical because I try and base stuff on logic. Like for me, the logic of let's take climate change. The logic of climate change is that we're all dead unless we solve that problem.
Yeah,
like that's pretty high up my agenda. You know what I mean? Whereas like I can see how like trans rights were ignored for decades. Okay, maybe I'm really ignorant about that, and rightly you have made that higher up the agenda than perhaps I thought it needed to be. So that's why I'm trying to bring logic into it as opposed to just call them nonsense.
Well, there's a reason why the word exists though, Howard. I think that's what we've forgotten. That's one of the problems we're getting wrong, Howard, is I think with the woke, is that we are getting rid of what we perceive to be negative nomenclature when sometimes some people are stupid and some people do talk nonsense. And I think we need to... There's a reason why... And I would say this. The reason why aristocracy exists is because of democracy. That because everyone has an opinion and everyone would volunteer opinion without that being researched, at some point, the more enlightened people got together and were like, we can't let everybody keep speaking at these town meetings.
But we had aristocracy far before we had democracy.
Well, I can see... You can see why it's been starting to make a comeback then.
Well, yeah, and also under socialist regimes, I mean, socialism, even though it's supposed to be, you know, equality for everybody, within like a generation or two, it turns into a feudal system because everybody preserves, you know, the prime roles for their family and their friends, and it becomes this, you know, almost a criminal gangster network. So that's what you could see happening in the Soviet Union. So, yeah, I mean, I think the only thing that really works is giving people autonomy and giving people sort of equal opportunities. Rather than trying to, I think the danger we've got now is where, you know, people think capitalism is broken, and it's not. It's working pretty well, and people want to move to some sort of you know, socialist utopia. But I don't think that's ever going to work, because as soon as you sort of structure things and have people being placed in roles and given money based on something other than, you know, what the market says, you're going down the path that ends in feudalism and nepotism.
Yeah, it's a very good observation. And I am so delighted to have engaged both of you on this conversation, even though we have, you know, the differing takes on it. And listeners, genuinely, I can speak for myself, I'm sure, Dane, we want to hear from you on this subject. Like, this is a big thing that, you know, there's a lot of what the woke movement is about that we actually do want to support, but we also want to try and understand what's going wrong. So, So listen, get in contact, and I'm going to hand it over to Dane for the final question of today's show.
Yes, thank you very much. I think we've covered many things. Based on what we discussed just now, you know, some people would argue, and a large part, and I think this might be, and this is a narrative which I get more from the right and the alt-right rather than the woke, and it's about, you know, that performing artists, creatives, comedians, which should stay out of politics. And it's surprising to see somebody who identifies as being right-wing politically is now not only opining on politics, but is now directly involved in politics for the Glasgow Pollock seat, for Glasgow Pollock, working alongside Lawrence Fox. Now, I just want to find out, really, what, basically, what do you think the benefit is as a comedian and a artist, technically, in being involved in politics?
To be honest, I mean, financially, there aren't many advantages. You get cancelled. You get cancelled from everything. This happened to Claire Fox when she ran for the Brexit Party. Certainly happening to me now. I doubt I'll ever perform in Glasgow. I mean, and the thing is, in Scotland, like, comedy is in the pocket of the ruling party. So the SNP own the biggest comedy clubs in Scotland, so the Stand in Edinburgh and Glasgow. I mean, I don't know if they're the biggest by number, but they're certainly the biggest by institution, if you know what I mean. And so they're owned by Tommy Shepherd, who is a millionaire SNP politician. And the bizarre thing is, like, Scottish comedians on the whole think that I'm some sort of establishment voice kowtowing to, you know, the establishment. It's like, man, I'm the only comedian who's like speaking out against the SNP, who are the ruling party in like what's basically a one party state, a banana republic with worse weather, which is Scotland. You know what I mean? So I mean, financially it's going to be, and reputationally it's going to be pretty ruinous for me. But I just think the hate crime bill is something I have to stand against. It's such an appalling bit of legislation. For the first time ever, it's criminalising private conversations in people's homes. People don't seem to realise that, you know, now everybody's got Alexa and stuff in their house. This is like science fiction movie dystopia time.
Yeah.
You know, the government can literally listen to what you're saying, and like anything you say can be interpreted as you know, some sort of, it doesn't need to have any sort of basis in logic or anything. If somebody perceives it, they can, you know, maliciously say, oh, I think that's racist, and then you get, even if the police investigate and clear you of any wrongdoing, and, you know, you go to court and the judge clears you of any wrongdoing, it's still recorded as a non-crime hate incident. And 120,000 of these have been handed out across the UK. And that is something that you can't clear it from your record. And it turns up in any DBS check. So that any future employer who does a DBS check on you will see, oh, he's got a non-crime hate incident for a homophobic, you know, verbal assault, even though, you know, it was nothing. It was a joke, you know, that somebody misinterpreted, or, you know, a misunderstanding. And then you can't get a job. So this is, and we're already seeing in America, conservative voices are being cancelled from work. I mean, Lawrence was famously cancelled, you know, for you know, denying that, you know, white privilege was all it was cracked up to be. And people are also being denied access to banking.
I mean, now, just to interject there, is when you say cancelled, what was he cancelled from? Was he already enjoying an illustrious career in the creative industry prior to this?
Oh yeah, Lawrence was a very successful actor. He was in a lot. So he was in that the Lewis, the, you know, Inspector Morse spin-off. But he was also in a lot of. He's in, you know, White Lines on Netflix. He's in a lot of movies. He worked with like Robert Altman. All these, you know, he was a very successful actor, making a lot of money. And he's been dropped by his agent, and you know, we're seeing this, and I'm hearing it from people that work in the media and work in the arts, and it's through other industries as well, but in the arts in particular, they're really afraid. People are really afraid that, you know, they're gonna be outed as you know, some sort of McCarthyist witch hunt, as having voted for the Conservatives or having voted for Trump. So everybody's putting these performative things on Instagram, being like, oh yeah, go Biden, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then secretly saying to me, man, I voted for Trump, you know what I mean? Like, it's mad. And I think this is why we've got, this is why right when...
Who are those people?
Well, I'm not naming names. I mean, even the slot we did on Nihal's show, that was, I mean, the guy sort of, you know, as soon as it came out that I'm, you know, running for Reclaim Party, the guy can't. But it's very hard to prove that you've been cancelled because, you know, people just say, oh, we're going to postpone it. We're not going to do it. You know, it's nothing to do with you. Or, you know, they just don't book you. You know, comedy clubs that used to book me don't book me. I haven't got worse at comedy. So you know, we sort of know why. Very few people have come out and said, I'm not booking you anymore because of your political opinions or whatever. You know,
I'm just going to say, as a member of the diaspora, this used to be called being blacklisted. Now it's happening to non-black people. It's called being cancelled.
Yeah. But yeah,
what's wrong with it being blacklisted?
Everybody talks about, you know, equality and diversity. Man, I want to see where are the equality and diversity reps making sure that there's enough, you know, Brexit voters on each panel. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
I mean, it should be. Yeah, I mean, you know, even though I would not feel like I'd be particularly enthused about performing for a room full of Brexit voters, but I have done before because I've also done Comedians Unleashed, and I thought it was a very good exercise. And it, you know what? It goes back to what we were saying before, Leo. I think when comedy allows for a moderation between these kind of views, and like you said, if people are made. I mean, you can remain ignorant and woke as well. And if you create an echo chamber which only speaks to a quasi-liberal or left narrative, then, you know, this allows for a vacuum for more extreme examples of the right to kind of flourish.
Yeah.
And it means that there's no kind of discourse. And it's like you said with your friend, like, you know, I think there is a fine line between racism, racial rhetoric or prejudice and or ignorant prejudice. Yeah. Like, you know, I did a show in Salford, and I remember a guy afterwards had came over to congratulate me for my set and, you know, referred to one of his cousins is coloured. Now, you know, that is a term that's seen as very pejorative in the UK, but if this guy came up to congratulate me and offered to buy me a drink, I feel like if he doesn't have the correct nomenclature, that's not an indication that he necessarily doesn't respect me as a person. And I feel like...
And this is one of the things that woke people do. They change the terms because, you know, coloured used to be the acceptable term. It was the term you're supposed to use, you know, back in the day. And then it changed.
It's still acceptable in South Africa as well. In South Africa, right. People still use the term coloured. And you know, that refers to people of dual ancestry. So it's even then, like, the terms change all the time.
Yeah.
And I can understand why the terms change, and I appreciate terms changing, and I think it's a good thing. But at the same time, people who aren't as savvy to the terms or maybe use an archaic term shouldn't be immediately dismissed as being racist or being immediately dismissed as being.
Let me chime in with a fucking good example of this, right? I'm a Jew, right? You can say the word Jew. Unless you put the word fucking before it, I'm probably not going to get upset. However,
unless you fucking.
However, the amount of people who don't know that the word yid is the equivalent or in a ballpark of racial slurs, you know, it's astonishing. You know, partly football has facilitated that because of the Tottenham thing. Yeah. But the idea that if someone said that word to me, I would obviously just say to them, hey, just so you know, like, that's kind of an offensive word. If their response was, no, it's not, I'd think they're a dick, right? Whereas if they turn around and go, oh, shit, really? And I'd be like, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, I'm not going to say the words that would be associated with it, but if you're writing a list, it's on the list. And it's an example where, you know, if someone said that, I wouldn't be like, well, that's the worst person I've ever come up. I'm never speaking to that person again because they didn't know that was an offensive word.
Yeah, whereas a lot of woke people would take that attitude. They'd be like, oh my God, this person, oh my God, they've broken the woke law. They must be cancelled. They must be banned. You know what I mean? And what I find, talking about anti-Semitism, because, you know, obviously it's intrinsically linked with Israel, but I find, you know, people criticize Israel and they say, well, I'm just criticizing Israel, so I'm not being anti-Semitic. And a lot of woke people say, I'm just criticizing Israel, I'm not being anti-Semitic. And it's like, well, why are you singling out Israel? What is it particular? What is it that's particular about Israel? In the whole, you know, in that area, there's a lot of countries with, you know, worse human rights abuses. So
I was about to say, their neighbours ain't exactly fucking winning awards for Pete. You know, Jesus Christ, ask Khashoggi. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that's why, you know, I'll challenge anyone to an Israel conversation on this podcast or anywhere they like, because I'm not pro-Israel because Jesus Christ, have you seen Netanyahu and the way they fucking behave? It's disgraceful. And I would never be a supporter of that. But this blind, you know, I was talking about the agenda earlier, right? This illogical agenda is just, I can't tolerate it.
Yeah.
And also, Israel, I guess, as a human exercise, is a clear demonstration that pronounced political disposition and humanitarian beliefs aren't always the same thing, because there are people who are pro-Israel but pro-human rights, and people that would be based in Israel and argue for the existence of Israel as a state but would also argue for the human rights of Palestinians.
Yeah.
It's not as cut and dry as that every single Jewish person living in Israel is pro-Zionist and doesn't give a shit about the West Bank. And it's not a given that every single, well, you know, a lot of the more traditional, I guess, Orthodox Muslim ideologues who speak about Israel give a shit about all Muslims. Because, you know, there are some Muslims, I think, because are Palestinians Shiite Muslims, if I'm not mistaken?
I think you're right, percentage.
But yeah, but I mean, you know, for Shiite Muslims that are based in Palestine or in Jordan or maybe Iran, or, you know, the minority based in Iraq would not be tribally or culturally supported by a lot of the superpowers based in these nations who do oppose the state of Israel. So it all comes down to, like, none of these things are always going to be clear cut. And the more we try and contextualize human perspective in these binary ways where I am this and therefore I can't be this, it's never going to work. It's like, for example, I'm not a monarchist. My parents are immigrants, you know, the monarchy among many other elites in the UK would have benefited from chattel slavery. So my mother was actually sad when Princess Diana died, and she was just sad when Prince Philip died. And I was like, what? Go. But, you know, she was like, well, he's an old man and he has a family and blah, blah. So maybe she's been able to, like, you know, look past all of the pre-existing stature and titles that precede. Mm-hmm. And she's looking at a human being, an old man who's a father and a grandfather, the great-grandfather, that's, you know, no longer been away with his family. So I don't believe that, by the way. But, you know, people are very, very different in that respect. So
We sadly have run out of time today, but Leah, I can tell you that when as this podcast continues, hopefully for many years, you'll be back on, hopefully as a Member of Parliament.
Well, Member of the Scottish Parliament. So if anybody's listening and they're in Glasgow and registered to vote, you can vote for me. Anyone in Glasgow can vote for me. I'm on the Glasgow list, and I don't even need to win. I just need to get, you know, a few percent of the vote, and it'll be a message that we need to roll back the hate crime law. And that would be a brilliant message to send to the SNP.
Sorry to interrupt you, Leo, because I think that's a great way to answer the question as well, is that why artists, and we should be concerned with politics, is because if we don't pay attention to it, both as human beings and citizens, is that we may find our own livelihoods being challenged right now. So, you know, despite a lot of Leo's political platitudes I don't agree with, I completely support and champion the idea that you are fighting for against this bill that will basically usher in an Orwellian style of monitoring for artists and creatives.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's
fuck Lawrence Foster. I'll tell him I said that.
He's a great guy. He's so misunderstood.
Listen, Leo, make it happen. Bring him on the podcast. We'll happily have him, Dane, won't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Tell Lawrence I'm sorry for the things I've said on Twitter. I'm open to have an open dialogue on my podcast. So,
that's what we're here for.
I will wind my neck in and I will apologise for my.
But we can do it. We can talk to people who don't. We don't all have to be the same. Yeah. But today, in some ways, has proved that, Leo. I hope you've enjoyed and not felt, you know, that we're the kind of people that you don't want to talk to.
It's great. I mean, it's great to speak to open minds, you know, no matter where they are on the political spectrum. It's great to talk to you.
And I think that is going to be the key for the next stage of human consciousness, that we're going to need to learn to talk to each other, guys, because it's what your mouth's for, mate. So, but again, Leo, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and please let the listeners know where else they can find your good works.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Leo Kerse, and I'm on YouTube. If you search for Leo Kerse, so I upload, you know, comedy videos every week or two.
Well, we're gonna share a few, because some of them are right up. if you're a fan of some of Dane's more cutting and controversial comedy, you'll love some of what Leo does. I'd say, because I wouldn't say they're linked, but they stand their ground in a very special way. A couple of the videos particularly, I think our audiences will enjoy.
Brilliant.
Well, listen, thanks again, Leo. It's been great.
Thank you. Really good, Leo, man. Thanks, man. And I'm following the podcast as well, man. So keep it up, man. It's really good, man. Really
thanks, good. Man. Cheers.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTiste. Our guest was Leo Kurse. You can follow Leo on Twitter at Leo Kurse. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.